We at the Thomistic Institute have a great opportunity for you. A gift to the TI before April 30th will send students to Rome for a whole semester to study in the heart of the church. Many students from secular universities are asking to be formed in the faith, but money is a big problem. Their scholarships don't transfer, and they can't afford the whole cost. They can't join the program without a little help. Will you answer their call with a gift to the Thomistic Institute? Thanks to your generosity, we will be able to form a new generation of church leaders. So please use the link in this episode or go to www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate to give.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Let me please indulge myself a little bit here in sharing a couple of reflections based on paper that are going to inform the rest of what we're talking about. So just to read the room, how many of you have read or have heard of Joseph Pieper? Okay, some people. All right, great. And then I assume this is you've read Leisure, the Basis of Culture? No, you've heard the name. Okay, good. You guys have, I've added to your Goodreads list, okay? And you can get going. All of those are wonderfully short and wonderfully accessible. All right, so that aside, right? In most translations of Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture, there's usually attached a secondary essay, The Philosophical Act, that makes the case that philosophy, in addition to religious contemplation, can draw us into meditative perception of God as creator. Only the Lover Sings, which was a later publication, serves as an extension to the argument that philosophy can enhance and supplement the religious pursuit of contemplation by offering reflections in art, literature, and music. And again, I'm really glossing over a whole lot of deeper philosophy that we don't have the time to get into. Just to get to the long and short of it, like the thing that I am assuming is that you, like me, might find some sense in what Aristotle says, that contemplation is heavily tied into the purpose, the end, the happiness of the human being. And so how are ways that human beings can pursue contemplation? For the Christian, religious contemplation, right? Going and joining the monastery, saying the office of the hours, making your holy hour, all of these are ways to pursue it, but Pieper is saying that there is a consonance between that and philosophical contemplation that also can be the groundwork for the same thing. Moreover, we have the arts that can lead us to this as well. So to back up the argument to its foundation, Pieper's conundrum is the same as we find in both Christian philosophy and its Greco-Roman precursors. What is happiness? What are the sorts of acts particularly fitted for humans to be happy? Pieper, like those before him, recognizes that human activities that are ends in and of themselves are more properly the end of the human being. For Pieper, this liberating act, to act without another end in mind, can only find its rest in God. And because it is directed towards God, this act is not a making where we work upon material, but a seeing, a listening, and observing where we are worked upon. He acknowledged that this can be embodied in countless actual forms, but there, as I said, there are two traditional forms that we usually acknowledge that are shortcuts to this kind of liberating activity: religious contemplation and philosophical meditation. In Only the Lover Sings, Pieper adds poetry, music, and the fine arts. And that really is the nature of this talk, to work out how precisely these three arts are particularly suited for the contemplative life. And in part, there's other lectures I have where I talk about poetry and the Christian life, where if you read Only the Lover Sings, you will be a bit, you aren't going to be disappointed, but he covers only music and the visual arts. And so that lecture that I have with the Thomistic Institute, you can go listen to that. Tries its best to offer the third, that is poetry and literature, and how to understand this as a liberating art. I should acknowledge that not everyone here might conceive of poetry, music, and the fine arts as ends in themselves. In fact, most contemporary criticism explores the arts almost exclusively as a means towards some other end, whether that is political, social, historical, commercial, or otherwise. And yet I would still hold that most of us instinctually, deep down inside, have a sense of revulsion and crassness when the arts are made instruments towards some other end. And you kind of think of like, I'm a 90s kid, right? And there was a moment not too many years ago when I was in the grocery store looking at produce and I heard Nirvana on for the first time in a grocery store as Muzak, right? And I was like, no, this is not what this art is about, right? This art is about rebellion or something else much more. Now, I'm not trying to praise it to the ends of the earth, but I'm saying like there's a certain crassness when you reduce it to commercial ends. As the great poet W.H. Auden once said in his beautiful poem in memory of W.B. Yeats, poetry makes nothing happen. It survives in the valley of its making, where executives would never want to temper, flows on south from branches of isolation and the busy griefs, raw towns that we believe and die in. It survives a way of happening, a mouth. So that is, at its core, Auden is suggesting that this very phrase, a way of happening, a mouth, that poetry is not a means to an end. That is, it has its own existence that is good in and of itself. All right, so as a talk for the TI, let's pause for a moment and resituate ourselves in what St. Thomas Aquinas has to say about beauty, move on to the sublime, and then reflect upon the relation. So there are two key passages about beauty in the Summa Theologiae. It makes an early appearance in the first part of question 5 on goodness in general. The pertinent passage runs thus. Beauty and goodness in a thing are identical fundamentally, for they are based upon the same thing, namely the form, and consequently goodness is praised as beauty. But they differ logically, for goodness properly relates to the appetite, goodness being what all things desire, and therefore it has the aspect of an end, the appetite being a kind of movement towards a thing. On the other hand, beauty relates to the cognitive faculty, for beautiful things are those which please when seen. And that's an important definition, right? What is the beautiful? For St. Thomas Aquinas, those which please when seen. Hence, beauty consists in due proportion, for the senses delight in things duly proportioned, as in what is after their own kind, because even sense is a sort of reason, just as is every cognitive faculty. Now, since knowledge is by assimilation, and similarity relates to form, beauty properly belongs to the nature of a formal cause. And that's a very important thing. And as you know, you can see I put it in bold, underlined, italics, and all caps. I very strongly suggest you keep in the back of your mind, remembering the phrase, beauty consists in due proportion. Among the lost books in antiquity I wish we retained, there is St. Augustine's early treatise, De Apto et Pulchritudine, on the fitting and beautiful, which, if we still had it, would perhaps be an interesting bridge between what we will soon discuss in ancient literary criticism and Christian aesthetics. Yes, St. Augustine wrote it before his conversion in Milan, but its thought reverberates in later commentaries we find of St. Augustine on the Psalms and elsewhere in his sermons. We catch glimpses of Augustine on beauty, but nothing like a full sustained treatise this must have been. But let us leave that aside for the moment and return to Aquinas. So just really quickly here, right? The question is, what is beauty? Is that which pleases? How is a thing beautiful? Number one, according to its clarity or brilliance. Number two, its proportionality according to its kind. And number three, integrity or wholeness of it. So this first part, going back to this first quote, Aquinas touches on beauty as a foil to explain that goodness is a final cause. And just really quickly, do we know what we mean when we talk about final cause, formal cause, or the four causes? Someone shaking their head. Good. But also people, a lot of people not agreeing and not shaking their head. Right? So we have four causes. We have material, efficient, formal, and final cause. According to Aristotle, that's then picked up in St. Thomas Aquinas. And I can explain it using this clicker, right? So this clicker has a material cause. It's got various plastics. If I open it up, I can see there's various metals that are used and chemicals in the batteries. I don't know if you want to consider the batteries integral. Need some sort of powder source, right? So that's its material cause. It has an efficient cause. It has someone who, you know, probably designed, well, let's be honest, these are probably machine-made, right? But there still had to be someone who made the machines, right? So there's someone who gets involved in the process. With natural things, it's a little simpler to find the efficient cause. For most of you as college students, you have two efficient causes. You probably need to call them a little more often than you usually do, or at least text them. Right, so use this, you know, lecture as an excuse to say, hey, mom, or hey, efficient cause A or efficient cause B, right? Thank you so much for life. Okay, so we have material, we have efficient cause, that which makes it, and then we have the formal and the final. So the formal relates to the idea of what a clicker is. I don't want to wax poetical about it. I just find it better than most philosophy classes where we just talk about chairs and chairness, right? So there was some engineer sitting in some sad desk at, Kensington, right? Or wherever, who had this idea for a ergonomic clicker, right? And who thought that he was going to achieve the ultimate end, right, of the idea of a clicker, and so instantiate it in an actual physical object, right? So he's working from an idea, building towards some end. And the end of it is not, again, that's what we call the final cause. The end of the clicker has certain functionality. If it wasn't able to move the slides back and forth, it would not be a proper clicker. And yet at the same time, I can pervert the end of it. So I can go home and I could just be really exhausted after this trip and see my cat sitting on the floor, and I could like take the laser pointer out and make the cat run around the room. Now, that's not why the Kensington engineer designed this clicker, right? That's not the final end of this clicker. And yet it can be used for other final ends. Well, not other final ends, other ends, not actually its true end, which is to move slides back and forth. Okay. So beauty then relates to the formal cause, right? And goodness relates to the final cause. We incidentally see that beauty is this formal cause. So of these things, right, we can say that since God is spirit, and we're talking about human beings, we have to understand the beauty of God is not the same as a formal cause as the beauty of, let's say, the clicker, the podium, my blazer, or this or that individual. Moreover, in this part of the Summa, Aquinas is demonstrating that God is the first cause of all things. The beauty of the Creator is unlike the beauty of created things. As the poet Gerard Manley Hopkins once said in Pied Beauty, all things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past all change, praise him. So this is a paradox in the poem between the nature of beauty in God versus the nature of beauty in created things. But I think we can all readily grasp where beauty lies in physical objects. So as it says in the slide, right, in due proportion, or to come in here, as we can just pull it out, the clarity or brilliance of it, the proportionality of it according to its kind and its integrity or its wholeness. So for human beings, though, there becomes a question of what is your beauty? Right? You are more than just body. And so St. Thomas Aquinas and others will say that beauty, therefore, when discussing the formal proportions, is related in particular to the soul. So he'll hone in this according to one particular virtue and say that this is the virtue of honesty. So honesty is where we find beauty residing in the soul. Now, there could be both beauty and body, but more proper to the human being is beauty of soul. And I think even you of college age students can identify with that. Sometimes you're walking on campus here and you might see someone who immediately catches your eye and then they say something or do something that is like absolutely, utterly atrocious. And the physical, whatever was appealing about the physical just utterly like vanishes, right? Because there has been something revealed about the interior life of that person that is heinous and reprehensible. So when it comes to poetry, literature, and beauty, things just got interesting, right? That is, embodies, it's the reason that lights upon the sensible, and spirit is honesty or intelligible beauty. There's this idea that honesty is beautiful and that you yourself can become more beautiful even as you age. So even as the physical body starts to show signs of lacking clarity or something like that, you can, and in fact, increase in the proper beauty according to the human person. The making and viewing of beautiful art is in sync with this and trains us for the contemplative life, trains that faculty of the soul in order to recognize and resonate with the beautiful. And at times it is an important function in the contemplative life. Think of the liturgy, the hours in the life of the medieval and even modern church, where there is beautiful art, there's beautiful music, there's poetry, that is being recited over and over again in a mimetic act in order to activate or resonate beauty inside the practitioner. And I'll kind of leave it this section of the talk with this reflection from the French philosopher Simone Weil, who makes the important distinction about why you need to build up these faculties inside of your soul in order to increase your beauty if you want to enter into contemplation. And she says, prayer consists of attention. It is the orientation of all the attention of which the soul is capable towards God. The quality of attention counts for much in the quality of prayer. Warmth of heart cannot make up for it. So if we can pause for a second before we move on to the sublime, I want to address this contemporary issue when it comes to seeing and hearing art, because I would argue that we live in an unprecedented time where we consume and emote more than reason and contemplate. And I want to show you this little chart here of thinking about this in terms of our experience of music, right? So in our experience of music, there's practicing, there's playing, there's what we consider, or I would consider the front porch, right? Of where there is a high level of ability for us to enter into contemplation, where there are rhythms of, if you're ever rehearsing the same thing over and over and over again, you're able to still your mind and go into sort of second nature, right? And your mind is able to meditate. I mean, for those of us who are practitioners of faith, you think of the rosary, right? There's something that's physically going on, and yet we're engaged in a much deeper level and are able to then use this as a springboard towards contemplation and meditation. So I would say that this is prime territory for us to actually enter physically and spiritually into the contemplative act. Next, I would say concert going, where there is more consumption, and yet at the same time, you are caught up and wrapped into the experience of going into the concert, where the feeling and the rhythm of the music can enter into you, and there is sort of an elation that can happen. And then I would say, again, pulling on the fact that I'm a 90s kid, right, the idea of the CD or having the music collection, where there's something sacramental about having a physical object, right? Even if it's a digital copy of the music, there's still this idea of curating it, of like, oh my gosh, my friends are coming into my room and they're going to see my CD collection and they're going to make aesthetic judgments about my taste in music, right? Or, you know, going back to the early 2000s, being in college, right, there's this girl that I like, I'm going to make a CD, and I'm going to curate the songs, and then you're going to like make, you know, whatever you decorative art you do on the CD. But today it's become sort of the playlist and the depersonalized, fragmented digital mediation of all of it, such that, I mean, I don't know, it doesn't seem like that sincere of a romantic gesture to share a hyperlink to a Spotify playlist to express our feelings. And then I would say even more, a disengagement completely where you're just solely consumer and there's no ability to contemplate is sort of the musical experience on these applications like TikTok or Vines, where the algorithm is just, you know, bouncing you from one musical medium to another musical medium without any sort of intentionality or contemplation of the viewer, right? And so you're merely just a low-level consumer as opposed to a highly intentional, activated, you know, human soul engaging in a very proper human art. So now it's my job to basically wreck everything that we've been trying to build up here about beauty and muddle it hopelessly or hopefully by discussing the idea of what is the sublime. So let me start with an invocation taken from Dante. It appears right in the beginning of his Paradiso. So when you heard I was talking about the beautiful and the sublime, an easy assumption would be that the sublime would be kind of this idea of all light and ethereal beatitude in Paradiso, like these examples that are illustrated in Gustave Doré's woodcuts to Dante. So on the left, you have an illustration from Canto 31 of Paradiso, and on the right, you have Canto 28 from the Inferno, where Bertrand de Born is holding aloft his own bloodied head, right? And so when we think about what is sublime, I think most of us instinctually, if we've not been sort of doing sort of forereading of it, might say that the sublime is the picture on the left and has nothing whatsoever to do with the picture on the right. And there's a sort of perfect Venn diagram overlap between beauty and sublimity. but it's my hope that this talk will make you question much of what you assumed was beautiful or ugly, crass or sublime. So here at the beginning of Paradiso, we find Dante invoking Apollo and saying, "O good Apollo, for this last labor, make me a vessel worthy of the gift of your beloved laurel. Up to this point, one peak of Mount Parnassus has been enough, but now I need them both. In order to confront the struggle that awaits, enter my breast and breathe in me as when you drew out Marsyas out from the sheathing of his limbs." Christ invoked under the guise of Apollo, the god of sun, light, reason. That's pretty good. It's pretty sublime, pretty beautiful. The peaks of Parnassus, where the muses sing, dance, and inspire poets, are lofty and elevated images, both literally and metaphorically. But what about Marsyas? Who is Marsyas? For those unfamiliar with the myth, the Locus Classicus at the time of Dante would have been the contest between Apollo and Marsyas in the sixth book of Ovid's Metamorphoses. For the crime of having challenged the god Apollo to a singing contest, it's like a reverse the devil went down to Georgia, right? So instead of beating the devil, Marsyas challenges a god to a musical contest. And for having challenged the god to the musical contest, Marsyas was flayed alive, right? So that is, he had his epidermis physically removed from his body. It's a very strange and it's a violent image to begin your description of paradise. And just think about that again, right? Dante's trying to say, I want to take you here. And so what I need God to do is inspire me in a way such that I feel like a satyr who is having his skin flayed off of him. It's a very strange metaphor. Is it beautiful? Right, according to the definition of what beauty is, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, if you remove someone's epidermis, it will neither improve the proportions of your body, nor will it add to its clarity. It's not the skin peel you're looking for, okay? And yet, as a metaphor for the poet who dares to outdo the word, capital W word, with his words, I will argue that this is a beautiful and sublime term of phrase. But before we return to how this is sublime, let us come to some sort of definition of the sublime. So the term is the Latinate form of the Greek tohupsos, which was the subject of the first century AD treatise ascribed to, definitely probably not written by, a man named Longinus, commonly called today on the sublime. The Greek refers to those qualities which make literature high or lofty. I prefer the Latin term sublime because it has the additional image of taking us up and beyond some imaginary barrier that separates the earth and the heavens. Go back to the slide. This is a famous woodcut of Empedocles breaking through the crystal sphere, right? And the idea being that the sublime is sort of the event horizon that we reach in our lives through poetry or something else that takes us up and beyond, and we have a whole new vision and landscape that is presented to us. So if we had a time for a course of poets on poetry, I'd argue that Pseudo-Longinus did not come up with the concept on his own, and that he stands at the end of a long tradition of thought going back to Hellenistic Alexandria. There, the idea of leptodes, or refinement, can be found in poets like Callimachus and Theocritus, as well as the scholastic commentaries that developed a sophisticated coded vocabulary to describe their approbation and dissatisfaction with turns of phrase in poets, ranging from Homer and Hesiod to Pindar and the Greek tragedians. Debate continued in commentaries and inside poetry in both Greek and Latin authors. However, Pseudo-Longinus gives our only extant handbook devoted to the topic, so we're just going to have to rely on him. And the category of the sublime, however implicitly present in aesthetic debate in late antiquity and the Middle Ages, did not reemerge as a focused subject of philosophical consideration until the republication of Pseudo-Longinus in 1554. So this is what I'm trying to, if I'm not clear, there's a lot of things I just threw at you right there. Aquinas doesn't have a sustained treatise on the sublime. Why? Because it was not an object or a concept of philosophical contemplation. It was kind of lost in the tradition. That is, there are these ideas that are present from it, and they're nebulously in the back, and there's principles. If it's the truth, then you're going to find it crop up in sort of skewed ways, like catching it in the back of the rearview mirror or the side mirror. But you're not going to find a section of the Summa Theologiae where St. Thomas Aquinas is going to talk about on the sublime, when he hardly even has any sections on the beautiful, but in and of itself. So if you're interested in the concept of the sublime, I feel like I'm obligated here to give you a few other like touch points. So even after this, 1554, it was another century before the concept came to the forefront of aesthetic thought during the Baroque period in 1674, with the translation into French of the On the Sublime by Boileau. Among the English, we find Pseudo-Longinus' presence throughout Edmund Burke's 1757, A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and Beautiful. And less than a decade later, after Burke, we see Pseudo-Longinus back on the continent and Immanuel Kant's Observations on the Feeling of the Beautiful and Sublime in 1764. And really, I'm just touching on the surface, but this is a concept that, you know, is flagged up much more leading up to the period of Sturm und Drang and Romanticism. Towards the end of this paper, I want to return to the sublime in modern and postmodern literature and thought, but since we're treading on this topic of Dante, it might be easiest and best for us here to stop short of the history of the sublime and return to Pseudo-Longinus. For Pseudo-Longinus, there are five means of achieving the sublime in literature. The first two only arise through the natural genius of the writer. So if you don't have it, you don't have it, right? It's sort of like watching Olympic athletes. First, there are thoughts of great strength or power. Second, there is the presence of vehement and enthusiastic passion. And then there are three concepts or techniques that you can cultivate and anyone can cultivate that are part of what makes the sublime. So for Pseudo-Longinus, these are lofty figures of thought. Fourth, there are lofty figures of speech. So this is what we might call diction, the actual words that we choose. And finally, there's lofty or sublime ways of arranging the words. So it would take far too long for me to go section by section to illustrate these, but let's pause for a moment to consider what Pseudo-Longinus might mean by the last artistic means of infusing literature with the sublime. So in Latin poetry, there is something called the golden line. For those who have taken a little Latin, you know it's a highly inflected language. It has a lot of leeway in deciding where to put words inside a sentence. And yet there are certain ways of ordering a sentence that are loftier. If you ever studied the Roman poet Virgil, you would have seen a few instances of the so-called golden line. Unlike English prose order of subject, verb, object, it was constructed such as you can see up here with adjective A, adjective B, verb, noun A, and noun B, right? And what this line says, a golden clasp fastens her purple cloak. And what he's able to do there is have the visual word order match the sense of what's happening here, right? The line itself is able to clasp just like the clasp does inside of it, right? And so it's one of these beautiful things that we can do in poetry where the sound and the sense are joined. But the phenomenon is not unknown in English. So let me give you an example of this, right? Shakespeare, right? To be or not to be, that is the question, right? I would argue that this is a sublime turn of phrase. If I were to put it together, the question is to be or not to be. Somehow, it just strikes me as less sublime. Extraordinarily not sublime is the No Fear Shakespeare. The question is it better to be alive or dead? Right? In a simple choice of words, to be or not to be, to be alive or dead, right? There is depths of meaning that are contained inside to be or not to be that are lost when you paraphrase and reduce it to, is it better to be alive or dead? And this is part of what we're talking about when we touch upon the idea of the sublime, the ability for poetry to hold manifold meanings that then are launching off points, that disturb and awaken wonder in you. I think this example of Shakespeare is a good moment to stop and situate the sublime in opposition to two extremes. So I think we've heard through the possible alternatives that the syntax of Shakespeare was sublime. The sublime, as with any excellence, this is Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics, but then many other ethicists who've gone on after him, will say that any virtue or excellence has two opposing vices, a deficiency or an excess. This idea of an excellence or virtue consisting of a mean between two extremes goes all the way back to Aristotle, as I just said. So for example, we can think of this like in the virtue of courage or fortitude, right? So that if I'm, what's the name of this main street that I came in on? 10th Street. So, and I saw there was like a New York style deli there, right? Is that one that people actually like or not? Oh, careful, this is recorded. So, what is something that we love? Again, like I'm here new to East Carolina University. So like, what is something that you guys really love on campus is food? Panda Express? Actually, you know what? Okay, I saw a little robot driving around campus doing that. Oh my gosh. We can talk after lecture about that in terms of like the dehumanizing of ourselves, right? Because again, like even food can be something that has aesthetic value to it, right? And removing the cultural context of sharing food. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. But if I'm walking down 10th Street and I have my Panda Express and I see a child in 10th Street and there's a bus coming, right? Courage or fortitude is the ability to risk death in order to achieve some good or to do some justice, right? And so if I drop my Panda Express to go save the child, right? That would be an example of courage or fortitude. Lacking that would be just kind of just like sipping, you know, my drink and maybe, you know, eating my orange chicken as the bus comes hurtling towards the child. Right? That would be a lack of courage or fortitude. That's a horrible thing, right, to contemplate. But also kind of comical to contemplate is the other thing where, you know, you're talking to your friend, you're trying to make a point, and your orange chicken, like you go turn to them and you hit your hand and the orange chicken goes into the street, but it's still in the box, didn't touch the ground, but the bus is coming, right? And it's getting so close. You know, you could just jump out there and you could grab that box of orange chicken and, you know, is it actually courage or fortitude to risk death to get a box of orange chicken? No, there's an excess there of what we call foolhardiness, right? So courage exists in you know, having some sort of, you know, right mind, prudence that can discern for you the right situation in order to act. So when it comes to the sublime, pseudo-Longinus in the Aristotelian tradition gives us two extremes that are opposed to the sublime. On the one hand, there is the puerile. For those who didn't take Latin, puerile comes from the Latin word puer for a boy. So it's childish, right? It's you know, boyish. So we might also call this the boyish or the immature. As he characterizes it, its immaturity comes from hasty and ill-considered ways of constructing the thought, right? So think of like ways in which we would maybe like try to convert Shakespeare into text messaging, right? You know, sort of like, I don't know, we're not going to do that as a thought experiment because it just makes me sad. But you could have that, you could do that, you know. I would say the No Fear Shakespeare is definitely a version of the question is it better to be alive or dead? Is a great example of what we might say of falling into the puerile, right? You're making it kind of too facile, and you're like removing the flavor in order to make it palatable at all to everyone, right? On the other hand, you could say that the sublime can also be missed by an excess, a certain pomposity. Pseudo-Longinus calls this the tumid or the swollen. That is, you might equally imagine myself butchering the sublimity of Shakespeare by coming up and saying, "I forsooth, ah, to be, yeah, verily, to not be, the question, the query," right? That sort of like, you're like, get to the point already, shut up, right? This idea of like, there's a certain right way of doing it that it has to skirt these two sort of Scylla and Charybdis. So there's this idea there that the sublime can come through syntax, arrangement, words. You know, we call it the Goldilocks principle. As you can see by this diagram, it's not always exactly clear that the sublime or the virtue of any virtue, where the exact demarcation is a general principle. It's more of a bell curve and less than the jagged line that I've demonstrated, right? And we could say that, you know, something like Shakespeare might be, you know, kind of hitting the sweet spot. You might think that an author like John Donne might be a little over here. You might think that an author like, I don't know, Robert Herrick. No one knows Robert Herrick anymore. Anyway, I would put perhaps over here. But anyway, so let's return to Dante for a second. In this invocation of Marsyas at the beginning of the Paradiso, "Good Apollo, for this last labor, make me a vessel worthy of the gift of your beloved laurel. Up to this point, one peak of Mount Parnassus has been enough, but now I need them both in order to confront the struggle that awaits. Enter my breast and breathe in me, as when you drew out Marsyas out from the sheathing of his limbs." So is this a thought of great strength or power? I would argue it is. Dante is trying to have you imagine the experience of being raised by God out of earthly experience and drawn up into heaven. In a sacrament, invisible grace is made present through visible signs. God is humbling himself to operate by our rules of knowledge. Now Dante is trying to give us a glimpse of knowing the world of grace and abandoning the world of the senses. And he can only do this to us creatures who come to know, as Aquinas says, through the senses. So he must give us a sensual image to illustrate going beyond the senses. It's kind of quasi-paradoxical. So does Dante present vehement and enthusiastic passion? I would argue yes. The idea of contemplating having your skin flayed off, by its very definition, is an enthusiastic passion. Right? He feels and asks us to feel the presence of God in a violent and enthusiastic way. This passion is so strong that it would ask to be flayed alive. Is this a lofty figure of thought? Absolutely. What loftier thought could there be than intimate union in mind with God for Dante? And does Dante use lofty figures of speech? Does his diction befit the thought? I don't want to get us bogged down in Dante's Italian, but I would say just so. Right? You listen to the lines describing the flaying of Marcius. Entra nel petto mio e spiritue, siccome quanto Marcia tristi della vigina della membre sue. So this sublime arrangement of words. So look at verse 19 here. See how the second person, entra and spiritue, right? So that's the second person, right? Surround petto mio, my breast, right? And it mimics the very idea that he's trying to convey. He's stripped out the outside of himself and exposed it to the winds and the spirit. So there's this way where even the caesura in the line imitates the separation of spirit and flesh. So there's a certain sublimity, I would argue, that comes about through that. If Dante were a painter or a sculptor rather than a poet, the images he presents of Apollo flaying Marcius alive might arguably not be sublime. But the effect here is meant to transport us out of what we know. It's a rather, and by the way, if you ever want something amusing, and it's a much later thing, but if you read The Theory of Moral Sentiment by Adam Smith, he has a wonderful passage on this when it comes to aesthetic philosophy, where he talks about, you know, we can have images of cannons and implements of war, and, you know, things that are, you know, can cause bad things to happen, people dying. But you wouldn't put, like, no one would have, like, as decorations on their wall, like, surgical implements or something like that, right? So there's sort of demarcations of what fits in one art form versus the other. But to return to the point, the effect here is meant to transport us out of what we know. It's a rather odd thing for metaphor to do. Most of us were taught in high school or thereabouts that metaphors in literature are meant to make something unknown to the reader, or sorry, to take something unknown to the reader and make it known. But think about what Dante is trying to do here in Paradiso. He's trying to rouse us out of our sensible knowledge to exploring the spiritual realities. The point of the metaphor is to inspire wonder, which, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, is the first step along the pursuit of wisdom. Wonder does not come from something known and commonplace, unless perhaps we see it in a new light for the first time and realize that we never really knew it. And college is a time for that, right? A time for realizing, like coming into the dorm room, like, you know, like, wow, water, it's wet, right? And of course, like most people, they came up to you and be like, okay, crazy, right? But there's a way where, you know, honestly, the beauty of reality should evoke that response from us. But most of us are too insensitive to it that we don't ever realize that. But what the poet is trying to often accomplish, or the artist is trying to accomplish, is that moment of seeing things for as they really are and being inspired by wonder. So you'd think it rather silly if I wondered it, so wonder can only be inspired by a realization that there's a deficiency in myself. And that's what makes wonder kind of a dangerous thing. Desire to know the unknown, to grasp the rainbow, to pull down the moon. That is wonder about earthly things, but how do I inspire wonder and desire in you for the spiritual realities that surround us? For Dante, it takes something violent and unexpected to strike us out of our complacency. The point is not the imagining of the physical pain of separating skin from flesh. The point is that there's a part of you, the spiritual faculties of the soul, capable of desiring and experiencing spiritual and philosophical realities outside of ourselves, that Dante must awaken. And then the shock of thinking of this soul as capable of receiving and responding to grace is as shocking to our ordinary lives as though someone were to peel off your very skin itself. Again, the point of metaphor for Dante and so many others is not to give you a surer knowledge in human language of realities that transcend ordinary human language. The point of the metaphor is not to confuse. The point of the metaphor is to cut you, to wound you in such a way that it reawakens a desire that lies within ourselves, right? As Aristotle says, right, all human beings by nature desire to know. There's these fundamental desires that can get crowded over by these physical and desires that are met and supplemented all the time, right? And so what ends up happening is you become anesthetized to the deeper things that are tied to your ultimate spiritual end. And this would go for the philosophers as well. That is, none of you were born with a natural desire for the iPhone 16. And yet somehow we live in this world where the iPhone 16 and Raising Cane's and your Panda Express and your robot that are going about campus are the things that are on our mind all the time. And so it's up to the artist to reawaken in you the desires for these deeper things that surround us. And so my hope for you is that you come out of this realizing and open to the ability that art in its beauty can both be highly intelligible, and art in its sublimity can open you up to a whole other adventure inside your life beyond just the day-to-day mundane. Thank you guys so much for inviting me to come talk about this.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.